Kids today are being attacked by dinosaurs, figuratively speaking. It seems dinosaurs are everywhere. They're on their clothes, they're on their beds, they're on their shoes. There's dinosaur food, there's dinosaur cereal, there's even the dinosaur bowl. The last few decades, it seems dinosaurs are everywhere. I think it's fine that kids are enjoying these great, terrible lizards, which is what the word means, these great extinct creatures, especially the larger species. But I do have one huge concern about the dinosaurs. And that is, as a rule, when the dinosaur story is being presented, the evolutionary theory is just assumed right along with it. I gave a lesson similar to this at the Athens Bible School in Athens, Alabama, years ago. And I was told even there was a dinosaur store in Huntsville. So I went there the next day, and sure enough, there's a dinosaur store and a lot of paraphernalia on dinosaurs or their view of dinosaurs. But equally, a lot of information on what I call the fictitious geologic time column. In other words, the age of the earth and when the dinosaurs began, prehistoric in comparison to man. A lot on the evolutionary theory, equally as much on that as the dinosaurs. By the way, I bought a mug while I was there, and it had the caricature of dinosaurs smoking cigarettes. And then the caption was, "The real reason they became extinct." You know, kind of cute. So the theory of evolution, unproven hypothesis. I call it actually an unproven hypothesis. However, it's been presented so long and with such craft, such fervor, that most people believe the dinosaurs evolved as well as man, that they predate man by many, many millions of years. And the time period will depend on who you're talking to. They wave time around like it's a magic wand. The first man and the first woman were ape-like creatures. They carried clubs, and they had a two-word vocabulary, ooga booga. Such ideas are absurd. They're completely unproven, and more importantly, they're completely contrary to biblical teaching. So what are the real facts concerning the dinosaurs? What happened to the dinosaurs? Well, dinosaurs were real creatures that once lived upon this earth, all over the earth, in abundance. Dinosaur fossils have been discovered on every continent of the earth in abundance, as far north as the Spitzberg Island in the Arctic and as far south as Antarctica. In the United States, countless dinosaur fossils have been unearthed all around the country. If you were to go to the Colorado-Utah border, there you would see the Dinosaur Museum. And as a part of the exhibit, there's a dinosaur graveyard. Hundreds of thousands of fossilized bones heap one upon another. And some of them are as small as a chicken bone, but other bones are larger than anything that is known to exist today. Now, a question that's often asked about the dinosaurs is this: if the dinosaurs existed, why aren't they mentioned in the Bible? Well, as a matter of fact, I believe they are. But please bear in mind that the Bible is not a book on zoology. Its purpose is not to catalog every species of animal. Did God create cats and kangaroos? Well, of course he did. But where are they mentioned in the Bible? Did God create rhinos and hippos and tigers? Well, of course he did. And yet, where are they mentioned in the Bible? The same could be said of various plants and birds. The Bible is not a book on botany, a book on zoology. It is a plan of salvation to redeem man from sin. And everything centers around this plan of redemption for mankind. If plants, animals, places are mentioned, they are incidental to the primary purpose. Look with me now at Job chapter 40, the book of Job chapter 40, please. Here we have some very interesting animals mentioned here as a part of this story. In Job 40, verse 1, it says, "Then the Lord said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it." Now, Job never cursed God as Satan insisted that he would. But in the midst of Job's suffering, he did question the goodness and the justice of God. And so now, beginning in chapter 38, the silence of heaven is broken, and God is addressing this matter of Job questioning the goodness and the justice of God. And God is presenting to Job these very humbling questions and these situations that Job knows exist far beyond his power. And so God is reminding Job of his place in comparison to himself and Job's very limited abilities in comparison to God's unlimited power, wisdom, and knowledge. And so we see things like this in verse 10 of chapter 40. "Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity. Clothe yourself with honor and majesty." Verse 11 of Job 40. "Pour out the overflowings of your anger. Look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Look on and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust altogether. Bind them in the hidden place." So Job, adorn yourself with majesty, and in the process, manage the things of this earth. Manage the realm of the dead. Bring the proud low and lift up those who are humble. And in the process, manage the realm of the dead. That's what he's talking about in verse 13. Manage the realm of the dead. In verse 15, now he talks about this great creature. "Behold now, behemoth, which I made as well as I made you. He eats grass like an ox." Now, behemoth is a transliterated word. It's not translated because we don't know what it is. We give it English letter equivalents to the Hebrew word. It's just simply come to mean in English something very large. We say it's behemoth, it's ginormous, but we don't know what it is. But we do know from the description here that is it is a herbivore. It eats grass. It's a plant eater. In verse 16, "Behold now his strength in his loins, power in the muscles of his belly." And look at this in verse 17. "He bends his tail like a cedar." That's a major clue. "He bends his tail like a cedar." Now, some publishers and translators will put in the margin suggesting it's a hippo, maybe an elephant. Those are the largest creatures known to us today. Maybe a giraffe even. But what does the tail of a hippo look like? What does the tail of an elephant look like? We've seen ropes bigger than the tail of a hippo. And when it says that he bends, this creature, behemoth, whatever it is, bends his tail like a cedar, that's not a Kentucky cedar. That's not a Missouri cedar. I mean, those are beautiful trees. They're weed trees. But they're not, the cedars they're talking about here were massive, impressive trees that might grow 120 foot tall with a 40 foot girth or circumference. They would build palaces out of this wood. They would build temples. The mast of a ship might be built out of a cedar. That's how impressive these trees were. And this creature, whatever it is, bends his tail like a cedar. And so again, it's not like any creature we have today. Verse 18, his bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. Verse 19, he is the first of the ways of God. From the description given here, maybe God means here in size and in strength, he's the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. God alone can overpower such a creature. Surely the mountains bring him food. All the beasts of the field play there. They're not afraid of him because he's a herbivore. He's a plant eater. Verse 21, under the lotus plants, he lies down in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. He loves the shade and the marshy areas. In verse 23, if the river rages, he's not alarmed. He's confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. He's so big. He's so strong. He can stand right in the middle of a rushing river and not be moved. In verse 24, can anyone capture him when he's on watch with barbs? Can anyone pierce his nose? It's a rhetorical question. So we have that creature, which is not like any creature we know of today, especially from what is said about its tail. But in chapter 41, God presents another creature. He's called Leviathan. Again, it's not a translation. It's a transliterated word because we don't have anything like this. And so we have to give it English letter equivalents. So verse 1, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Evidently, no one dared to do so. If they did, they regretted it. Down in verse 7, let's skip through a little more. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Rough, scaly skin. Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Probably not live to tell about it. Behold, your expectation is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? And so even the sight of him would be very intimidating, and the battle would be lost just in seeing him. In verse 10, no one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? And so as God is describing this impressive creature, he reminds Job right in the middle of this of the main point, and that is no sensible man would confront or challenge Leviathan. And then the point is, would you be even more foolish and challenge and confront me, the one who made Leviathan? You know, that's the point of all of this. God made all of this. And so let us be in awe of God. In verse 15, his strong scales or his pride shut up as with a tight seal, one near the other. No air can come between them. They're joined together. They clasp each other. They cannot be separated. The outer covering of this creature are like multiple rows of impenetrable shields. In verse 18, his sneezes, look at this, his sneezes flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches, sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils smoke goes forth, as from a boiling pot burning rushes, his breath kindles coals, and a flame goes forth from his mouth. You know any creatures like that today? There's no simile here. God doesn't say it's like this or like that. He says, burning torches go forth. Sparks of fire leap from his mouth. That's what it says. Smoke and light from his nostrils. I see no reason in the text to not take this literally. Verse 25, when he raises himself up, the mighty fear, because of the crashing, they are bewildered. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw, bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into stubble before him. This is a mighty, mighty creature, whatever it is. In verse 33, he says, nothing on earth is like him, one made without fear. Reminder again that he was made by the very one who is saying this. Now, if the electric eel can produce enough electricity to stun a horse without shocking itself, if a Komodo dragon can store enough deadly bacteria inside its mouth to greatly harm its prey without hurting itself, if a bombardier beetle, which we still have today, the bombardier beetle, can, from two reservoirs in its tiny little body, emit chemicals that come together as a defensive mechanism, producing a spark. It's a small bit of fire, you might say, but a spark that they have measured to be 212 degrees. Then God can create a creature like Leviathan that can breathe fire even from its mouth without burning itself. Now, it's obvious such a creature, to our knowledge, doesn't exist today, but he once did. And Job was well aware of it. Otherwise, God's teaching here would be ineffective. And so are we saying then, am I saying that dinosaurs lived during the same time period as man? Absolutely, I'm saying that. I believe that's what the Bible is showing here. And the Bible teaches in other places. Dinosaurs are not prehistoric. They did not predate the existence of man. Look back with me at Genesis chapter 1 now. Genesis 1. And there in verse 20, in the midst of the creation account, we'll come in on the fifth day. Genesis 1:20. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. God created the great sea monsters and every living creature, not just some, that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind, God saw it was good. In verse 23, this was the fifth day. And then verse 24, then God said, we're into the sixth day now. Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle, creeping things, and beasts of the earth after their kind. It was so. Verse 25, God made the beast of the earth after their kind and the cattle after their kind. And everything, notice not just some, everything that creeps on the ground after its kind, God saw that it was good. Now, still on the sixth day, verse 26, God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle, over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. All this that God had made, man would have dominion over them. In verse 31, God saw all that he had made. Behold, it was very good. There was evening and morning the sixth day. And so the Bible shows that God created all the land, all the water, all the flying creatures on the fifth and the sixth days. And in chapter 2, In verse 19 and 20, God gave Adam the privilege of naming all of these marvelous creatures. Verse 19 of chapter 2. Out of the ground, the Lord God formed every beast of the field, every bird of the sky, and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. Whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all the cattle, to the birds of the sky, to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him. And so the scripture shows that man and all God's wonderful creatures, including the dinosaurs, since all creatures were made in these days, existed at the same time. Dinosaurs have no relation to the evolutionary hypothesis. They are simply extinct animals. Like the saber-toothed tiger, the three-toed sloth, the dodo bird, the stellar sea cow, all of these are creatures of an earlier time, some of them more recent than others, but now extinct. Dinosaur fossils, many, many dinosaur fossils, however many you find, wherever you may be, they don't reveal any transitional stages of evolution. There's variation within the species of size and color and maybe even defense mechanisms, but there's no transitional stages. No evolvement from one kind into another. No interrelation of the kinds. No transitional stages at all. And even Darwin, in his book, Origin of the Species, he recognized this. And he wrote this very, very important statement. He said, why, if species have descended from other species by fine gradations, do we not everywhere see innumerable transitional forms? He was admitting we don't see that. Why is not all nature in confusion instead of the species being as we see them well defined? But as by this evolutionary theory, innumerable transitional forms must have existed, why do we not find them embedded in countless numbers in the crust of the earth? That's a logical question, and it should have led Darwin back to belief in God, which he once had before all of this. No transitional stages. They simply don't exist. And the reason for that is because, as we see in Genesis 1 and 2, God created everything mature, full grown, by miracle, with a time element built in. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? The chicken, of course. Dinosaurs are not prehistoric. No living creature is prehistoric. Such talk is false. It's misleading. It's not biblical. Dinosaurs, like all creatures, were part of God's six-day creation. They were all part of biblical history. So what happened to the dinosaurs? Well, look with me now at chapter 7 of Genesis. What happened to the dinosaurs? Genesis chapter 7. God commanded Noah to enter into the ark, which he was to have made, he and his household. And there in verse 2 of chapter 7, you shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of all the animals that are clean too, a male and female. So two pair of the unclean animals and seven pair of the unclean. And the details of cleanness and uncleanness are given later on in the law. Now, the command given here in chapter 7 doesn't require every species of animal. It doesn't say that. The command given here in chapter 7 doesn't require that they be full grown. It doesn't say that. And it is very possible that some of these creatures, at least, could have been dormant or in a hibernating state. All the animals that are not on this ark, on the earth, they would have perished in the great flood. And God is very redundant in helping us to understand that. Everything that's not on the ark on the earth perished. In chapter 7, verse 19, it says, the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under heaven were covered. Now, the implication of that is universal flood. All the high mountains were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. All flesh that moved on the earth perished, birds and cattle and beasts, every swarming thing that swarms on the earth, all mankind, of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, died. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, man to animals to creeping thing. God is, again, very repetitive of this fact. Only animals in the ark survived. All the others perished. So how did Noah fit all of these animals into the ark? That's a question frequently asked. Well, the ark was, if you use a cubit to be 18 inches, which is the short cubit, the ark was 450 foot long, 75 foot wide, and 45 foot high. Three levels divided would be about 95,000 square foot. 1,396,000 cubic foot, the carrying capacity of 522 stock railroad cars. It's estimated that two of every kind of animal today, not species, would fit into 150 railroad cars and certainly leave plenty of room for food. Verse 20 of chapter 7, the water prevailed 15 cubits higher and the mountains were covered. All flesh that moved on the earth perished, birds and cattle, beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth, and all mankind, everything that was on the dry land. Only those in the ark would have lived. But even the survivors, those that are in the ark, when it was time to leave the ark, they would have walked out into a very, very different world, a different climate, different topography, different vegetation, different productivity of whatever grew. And then, of course, a number of other factors would contribute to the death of these creatures. Other animals preying upon them, sickness and disease, additional climate changes. And of course, man himself. Bert Thompson, who's editor of the religious journal Reason and Revelation, he made this observation, which I think is very interesting here. The trilobite, a small marine arthropod with a hard skeleton, is considered so important as to be classified as the index or time fossil for the earliest period, that which they consider the Paleozoic or Cambrian period, way before man, they say. In fact, they say a half a billion years before man. And yet in June of 1968, there was a man, Mr. William Meister, an amateur archaeologist working near Antelope Springs, Utah. He made a discovery that was to destroy, and I'm continuing to read what Thompson says, that would destroy evolutionary supposition. Working his way up the side of the mountain, some 200 foot to a ledge, he broke open a slab of rock with his hammer. And imagine his astonishment when he saw, and he quotes Meister here, on one side, the footprint of a human with a trilobite right in the footprint itself, and the trilobite had been smashed down by the footprint. The other half of the rock slab showed an almost perfect mold of the footprint and fossils. Amazingly, the human was wearing a sandal. Now, since that discovery by Meister, additional human footprints have been found in the area. Not with the trilobite in it, but in the area. And in various places throughout the world, numerous human footprints have been found along with are crossing over dinosaur footprints. And so the so-called geologic time column is just utter nonsense. It's fictitious. And the facts of geology actually support creationism. They do not support evolution. And so what are the facts? Dinosaurs existed throughout the world at one time in great numbers. Dinosaurs did not evolve. They were created on the 5th, 6 days of creation week. They did not predate man, but existed the same time period as man. Dinosaurs do not present a problem to creationists, but they do to the evolutionary theory. With numerous footprints of humans and dinosaurs in the same rock strata, trilobites in human sandal prints, human footprints in coal veins, drawing of dinosaurs on canyon walls, hundreds of years old. Did they draw those dinosaurs from fossils or from actual animals they saw? I suggest the latter. Well, the evidence speaks loudly against the geological timetable of evolution and in favor of creation. Now, God, who made those creatures, who made Leviathan, who made these marvelous creatures, is a powerful God. One we should constantly be in awe of and in reverence toward. And the same power he had to create these marvelous creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan and so on, the creatures we see today, this earth, this universe, he has that same power available to make you a new person, to create in you a new heart, to transform your heart and your mind, your soul, into the kind of person he created you to be. All of us have sinned and we've fallen short of his glory, that which he intended for us to be. We've fallen far short of that. But through his son, Jesus Christ, and this transforming, powerful word he's given to us, he can make you anew once again. He can make you into the kind of creature, the person he always wanted you to be, as his daughter, as his son, spiritually speaking, and which hopefully you want to be. Don't you want to be that person? God has the power to make you that person. If you'd have faith in him, believe in him, transform your life, conform your life to his will, give your heart to him, trust him. Don't just believe in him. Believe him. Trust him. He will transform your life. He has the power to do this. He has the power to do that in your heart. Be baptized into Jesus Christ for remission of sins. If you'd like to study some of these things further, I'd love to sit down with you and study things, evidences like this further with you. I love looking at things like this, and hopefully you would enjoy that as well. But if you'd like to take this opportunity to go ahead and come to Jesus Christ and confess your faith in him before this good audience, then an opportunity is provided right now. Make that known to someone nearby, someone sitting near you, or come to the front if you'd like to. Maybe after services, make that known. Our brother Brian has selected a song to further encourage you to make that good decision. Will you come as we stand and sing, please?